Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think what makes Indiana particularly interesting right now is this diversity of activity that's taking place simultaneously.
That's author David Hoppe. He says large and small farms can learn a lot from each other's strengths and weaknesses. He's joined by photographer Kristen Hess to talk about their book of profiles of farmers, producers, chefs, and hunger advocates. Harvest Public Media goes to Iowa to report on the increasing number of CAFOs in the state. We talk to a cookbook author who teaches us how to sprout quinoa. And speaking of which, following a decadent Thanksgiving, we take it easy with a couple recipes using quinoa. One will help you use up the remaining shards of turkey. Our news headlines are shorter than usual during the holiday. Luann Johnson is here.
It's been a few weeks since we updated you on the progress of the Farm Bill, mainly because there's been no progress. The bill is more than a year overdue at this point. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke with USA Today this week about what could happen if a new Farm Bill is not passed by January 1st. Not only could that result in milk prices doubling, American livestock producers, who have been hit by storms and drought, could be stranded without standard federal assistance. For the first time in human history, income will have a greater influence than population growth on food security. That's according to a new study out of the Purdue-based Global Trade Analysis Project. Distinguished professor of agricultural economics Tom Hertel told Purdue Agricultural News that individual incomes are increasing in many parts of the developing world, and with that growth will come more demand for richer, more nutritional diets. This will require global farmers to double their yields by 2050. Hertel says the next step in the coming decade is to determine how to sustainably feed the planet. And we have more and more free time, but researchers observe that we aren't getting happier. Could fast food be to blame? A study from the University of Toronto aimed to look at the psychological consequences of fast food. It determined that people living in neighborhoods with more fast food restaurants were less likely to savor something pleasurable. During the study, researchers showed participants pictures of a fast food burger and fries and then played, quote, a harmonious opera aria, unquote. They then measured how much people enjoyed the music and how long they felt it lasted. The results were that people who had seen fast food were less pleased by the music and said it seemed to go on longer. The conclusion was that when people thought about fast food, they were less likely to savor something pleasurable, which indirectly impaired their ability to derive happiness. Researchers cautioned that more work needs to be done to figure out just how fast food and happiness are intertwined and how strong the relationship really is. More about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
Share stories with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're posting there all the time. Connect with us by searching for Earth Eats. Luann Johnson reads our headlines. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks to tight competition, hog farmers all over the country are feeling a push to expand or get out of the business. That means indoor confined animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are growing even in the most environmentally sensitive areas. Clay Masters reports for Harvest Public Media on a CAFO fight in Iowa.
Chris Wasta sports a red ball cap, hip waders, and carries a homemade bamboo fly fishing rod. He owns a small business that makes specialty timber frames up here in northeast Iowa's Winnesheek County, near Decorah. He's an avid fly fisherman, and on this day, he takes time out of his morning to cast a line on Bear Creek, with the backdrop of sweeping limestone bluffs.
Most of the year, when the leaves are on the trees, you're barely aware how rocky the terrain is around here.
Like many in the area, Wasta is concerned about the growing hog industry's impact on the water supply here. This part of Iowa is in a swath of the Midwest that includes Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Illinois, called the Driftless Region. Iowa fisheries biologist Bill Kalishik with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources says the trout streams are here because underneath the ground surface, there's limestone.
Surface flow can percolate into the limestone. It goes down into the groundwater. It then reemerges as springs. You don't have this in the rest of the state because you don't have this real shallow limestone layer right underneath the soil.
Kalishik says this kind of topography is more environmentally sensitive to manure spills from mismanaged CAFOs, and spills happen in this state and others every year.
Something goes wrong in a system, and there's a catastrophic failure of the way that they handle manure in the system, and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of gallons of manure can get put into a stream.
It's because of that possibility people in the county were upset when ag company Millennium Agriculture announced it would expand its operation to house more than 4,000 hogs. And that's a pretty big CAFO. The Iowa pork producers say an average facility houses about 2,400 hogs. The Winnesheek County Board of Supervisors tried to block the expansion permit. Winnesheek County Supervisor Dean Thompson brought their concern to the state's Environmental Protection Commission.
We felt that given the location of that animal feeding operation near Bear Creek Watershed, and given the public input, it was part of our responsibility to pursue the question and ask why it should be expanded.
Millennium can expand because the company is doing nothing to violate Iowa law. Eldon McAfee, a lawyer who represents the company, says there are extra safeguards put in place in this kind of topography, including a concrete pit that stores the manure.
From this type of confinement operation, Iowa law just says no discharge, period. Nothing gets away. It has to be designed and operated that way.
That stored manure has an added bonus for farmers in the area. Chuck Gipp, the director of the Department of Natural Resources, lives in Decorah. The former Republican state lawmaker grew up on a dairy farm up here and says technology has improved immensely since he was young when manure just ran off into the streams. Now the manure is stored and benefits neighboring farms.
Confinement, you capture that liquid. And if you handle it properly, it can be a very good soil nutrient, better than commercial fertilizer.
Ultimately, the Environmental Protection Commission gave the company the green light to expand. Millennium isn't wasting any time. It plans to break ground soon. But that potential from a catastrophic spill still concerns many residents in Decorah, like Tom Murray. He moved here to retire and get away from Chicago.
It affects everything we do. I mean, water is everything to us for life.
Which explains why in Decorah and other communities coexisting with CAFOs, water is under constant scrutiny. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Clay Masters.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media, harvestpublicmedia.org. Indiana is in the midst of a food renaissance, with an increasing number of farmers and producers starting agribusinesses of all shapes and sizes. We found an interview from earlier this year that tries to find out what's in the water in Indiana that's causing the surge.
Well, that's kind of the $64,000 question.
That's author David Hoppe. His new book, Food for Thought: An Indiana Harvest, explores why through profiles of farmers, producers, chefs, and hunger advocates from across the state. The book was commissioned by the Indiana Humanities, so their goal was to collect stories from across the entire Hoosier food spectrum. He and photographer and co-author Kristen Hess came into the Earth Eat studios to talk about their work.
I think there are a number of things happening in the state. It's not necessarily unique to Indiana because we know that food awareness, food interest, food faddism for that matter are all very hot right now. Food's a hot topic. Part of that has to do with the fact that mass media is covering food in ways that they never have before. We have a food network on television. We have celebrity chefs. But we also have a much greater interest in our own health. We're more concerned about what we're eating, what's going into the food that we eat, how that food is prepared. And also there's an increased interest in supporting local business, local entrepreneurs. And that ties into farmers markets, for example, and providing greater support for small and artisanal farmers, for example. So all of these things seem to be converging at once. I would also add one thing that's very Indiana-specific too. And as Kristen and I traveled around the state and talked to people, it was very hard for me to shake this kind of intuitive sense that at the same time that Indiana's manufacturing base was really taking a very hard hit, it was almost as though the state's economic immune system was kicking in. And suddenly we had all of this burgeoning activity happening on the agricultural front, as if somehow to compensate. It's very interesting that we have so many people now in Indiana going off on their own, starting what are really very risky ventures in many cases, but really trying to capitalize on this tremendous interest in food. And in some cases, succeeding wonderfully at it.
Well, then let's, I guess, talk more generally about our interest in food as a country. Mm-hmm. Why now?
I think there's a real interest and a desire for transparency. I don't know if it's the rise of social media and the ability for everyone to kind of generate their own media, but it seems like people are really wanting facts and they're wanting to communicate what they want. They want to embrace localism through global networks. And so I think that, you know, that's a huge component of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was flipping through this and I got to one of my favorite producers in Indiana, Trader's Point Creamery.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I flipped to the next page and it's deep fried Twinkies at the Indiana State Fair.
Uh-huh.
So your book covers a lot.
Well, actually, you know, if you want an interesting study in contrast, I mean, you can talk about the Trader's Point Creamery, where you have a couple who have created this business, and they are endeavoring to raise grass-fed organic cows and producing really high-quality whole milk, yogurts, and other dairy products. And they have done this on an artisanal scale. They've also expanded their business, turning it into a farmer's market, a restaurant, and they're doing this within the context of the city of Indianapolis. They're right on the outskirts of the city. That's one case. We happened to interview them one morning, and then that afternoon we went up to Fair Oaks to talk to the CEO of the Fair Oaks Dairy. Now, Fair Oaks, unlike Trader's Point, is one of the larger dairy operations in the United States. It, too, has become a major destination for what's called agritourism. Fair Oaks opens itself up to the public, and you can go watch calves being birthed. You can watch some of the hundreds and hundreds of cows being milked automatically. It's a real interesting study in contrast, and yet at the same time, both of these businesses are attempting to do the same thing. Both are attempting to survive, in a sense, by making themselves destinations for the public, offering two very different experiences, but working within the same overall context, which is dairy. The interesting thing about Fair Oaks, to me at least, is that because of its very large scale, they've been able to actually take themselves off the grid. They're producing all their own energy. They have figured out a technology to be able to collect all the waste of those many, 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 many cows and turn it into energy, which powers the operation there, even provides fuel for their trucks, which carry their products down to Florida. And I find that very interesting. I mean, the reason they're doing that, the impetus for doing that, was because they wanted to be good neighbors within the context of the place where they're located, which is just south of Merrillville. You know, if they weren't as big as they are, they wouldn't be able to be doing these things with energy. And I find that really fascinating.
I think, too, that the reason we were able to capture such a wide spectrum is because our focus for the book was on gathering stories. And so, you know, when we were talking to people, we were more focused not on investigating their agricultural processes as much as getting to know them as people. I mean, the book was commissioned by Indiana Humanities. And so because of that, our goal was to capture human culture with relation to food. And so that's why, you know, we got the immigrant stories and the large scale ag and small and hunger advocates and, you know, the whole range. That was really important to us.
And that's something that's very important to bear in mind about what's happening in Indiana right now too, which is that you have this byplay going on between very large agricultural operations and small artisanal operations at the very mm-hmm. same time. This creates a certain tension without doubt, but it also hopefully provides some useful information to people. One of the problems with large agricultural operations does have to do with the amount of waste that they produce, their impact on the environment, their impact on rural communities. At the same time, for the smaller producers, they're having real issues with regard to distribution, with regard to creating access to their products. It would seem that both of these players would have important things to learn from one another. So I think what makes Indiana particularly interesting right now is this diversity of activity that's taking place simultaneously.
Author David Hoppe, photographer Kristen Hess, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Hear my complete conversation at eartheats.org. Coming up, name this ingredient.
It's something that we've been seeing in the big restaurants and health food restaurants for a few years now, but it's really becoming mainstream, and everybody knows that it's a very healthy seed, and it originates from South America, and it's got a lot of protein in it.
Did you guess quinoa? Well, that's the base of our two recipes coming up in the second half of the show. We found a tasty recipe from earlier this year to revive, and another one for soup that'll help you use up those turkey leftovers from your holiday meal. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We did an informal survey around the Earth Eats office. What's the favorite leftover turkey recipe? Well, the overwhelming winner was, not surprisingly, the hot turkey sandwich. But Chef Daniel Orr, you know, he likes to get a little bit more creative than that.
There's a lot of great things you can do with leftovers, and almost each part of the bird has a special use for leftovers. The thighs are great for turkey pot pies and that kind of thing. I love to make make a turkey hash out of the leftover turkey and mix it with some of the stuffing. and serve it with poached eggs for breakfast. So that's a great Friday after meal that you can have with your leftover turkey. You can also make lots of different things like quesadillas. You can take it in that kind of Mexican south of the border type direction with quesadillas or enchiladas. So there's lots of different things with the breasts. You can make a turkey tetrazzini, which is kind of an Italian type of dish where you layer it. It's almost like a turkey casserole.
Quinoa is high in protein, but not only that, it's a complete protein, which means it contains a balanced set of essential amino acids. It's also high in iron, dietary fiber, and it's gluten-free. You can sprout the stuff, and unlike the 12 hours it takes to sprout wheat, it only takes quinoa 2 to 4 hours to grow its little tendrils. It's no wonder this little seed has been called a superfood.
So simple to cook. Basically, all you do is you pour it into a pan, cover it with water, and cook it. And you just need to keep adding water until you see these little kind of white, wormy-looking things. Doesn't sound very appealing, but it's really, really tasty. If you just grab a little handful of that, I put a little bit of garlic, salt, and pepper, and a little olive oil with it. I had some smoked turkey broth, put the quinoa in there, some carrots, some collard greens. You could throw leeks, you could throw turnips, you could throw parsnips, anything you want in there. And then the kumquats, the little oranges that are in there, give it a really fun, interesting flavor and make it very different. And they have a nice citrus pop as you eat them.
Those kumquats are little fireballs that explode when you bite into them. They sure do add an interesting zing to the soup. Try it for yourself. Print off the recipe at eartheats.org. We looked on our bookshelf, and sure enough, there's a cookbook we need today. Quinoa Revolution. Over 150 healthy, great-tasting recipes under 500 calories. Author Carolyn Hemming and her sister Patricia Green are quinoa lovers from way back, so they're enjoying the recent trendiness of this edible seed.
Yeah, it's kind of taking the culinary world by storm, really.
In fact, Carolyn and Patricia have branded themselves as the Quinoa Sisters.
Not only is it great tasting, and you can use it in a myriad of applications, but it also happens to be a complete protein. It's full of vitamins, full of minerals, great for vegetarians, gluten-free, high in fiber, low glycemic index, complex carbohydrates. I mean, the list goes on.
Here's 1 minute with Carolyn Hemming, where she talks about sprouting quinoa.
So sprouting quinoa, really distilled water, half a cup of quinoa. You want to make sure that everything is really clean, including your clean glass or your dish, and that you've got a lid for it. Pour the distilled water, cover the quinoa, give it a little bit of a stir, and soak it for about 40 minutes at room temperature, and then strain it off after that, drain the seeds, and give them a bit of a rinse with some more distilled water, and then rinse out the dish as well, of course, and then return the wet quinoa rather to the dish and cover it again. Leave a little tiny opening to get a little bit of air in there, and then put it in the fridge or a dark, cool location, and rinse it, you know, every 8 to 10 hours until the quinoa is sprouted to however long you want it. You know, quinoa germinates in 2 to 4 hours, so, you know, you can sprout it really quick and have small sprouts, or you can let it sprout to 8 hours and have a longer, more, you know, substantial sprout.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great. Have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. Read the complete interview with Carolyn Hemming on our website. You'll also hear about a recipe for Black Forest goat cheese brownies using quinoa flour. The picture alone will activate your sweet tooth, I'm sure. See it at eartheats.org. Chef Daniel Orr has a bag of rainbow quinoa in the kitchen today. It's a combination of white, red, and black quinoa.
All right. We ready to go?
Do it.
Okay, well, it's all about quinoa today. It's something that we've been seeing in the big restaurants and health food restaurants for a few years now, but it's really becoming mainstream, and everybody knows that it's a very healthy seed, and it originates from South America, and it's got a lot of protein in it. Now, if you were to grow your own quinoa, you would need to really wash it well because it's coated with kind of a bitter coating, dusty coating, that the plant creates actually to make birds spit it out. So birds would eat it and they'd spit it out and it would make the plant grow different places. So it's another one of those wonders that, you know, animals and plants living together on this earth. We're going to start with a little bit of oil. You could use kind of a pumice olive oil, a kind of inexpensive olive oil. We've got a nice hot pan. Quickly, we're going to add the garlic. Now, you don't want your garlic to get too dark, so you need to have your onions ready. It's just brown, boom. So that was about 2 tablespoons of garlic, 1.5 to 2 cups of onions. We're going to add just a touch of water to that, and that's going to help it steam and cook those onions quickly. And we're going to let that water evaporate out of there. Season these with a little bit of salt and pepper and some thyme leaves. I've got probably about a teaspoon of fresh thyme leaves, salt and pepper, and a little bit of lemon zest. Again, one of my favorite secret ingredients. Okay, and then in the meantime, you have your quinoa on cooking. And basically what I like to do is to toast the quinoa in just a little bit of oil until it gets a little nutty. Then I cover it with water. It takes about 12 to 15 minutes to cook. Then you let it sit, and then you take a fork and kind of aerate it. And when you've used the rainbow quinoa, you really get all these extra colors, which really make it beautiful. We're going to continue to cook the onions until they're nice and brown. You can see they're very well caramelized. We're going to add our quinoa to this. I grab a spoon. And we're just going to check the seasoning. Again, it's so important. A lot of people follow recipes to a T, and then they forget to check the seasoning. Let me give it a taste now. A little salt and pepper. Going to squeeze a little fresh lime juice or lemon juice on top. And again, this is a great side dish. Would be good with any type of roast meat. Wonderful as a bed underneath things, like you could put a piece of grilled salmon on top of it. You could also cool this down or use your leftovers as a salad the next day, or put it in a pita sandwich, or use it just about any way you wanted to. So very, very versatile. Okay, we're going to serve this. And one thing I always have at the restaurant are roasted tomatoes. Grab a couple of these. They're nice and herbaceous. Tossed in herbs and olive oil and roasted in the oven. Throw a touch of the Irish, a little green on top. And there you go. That's our rainbow quinoa with roasted tomatoes and a touch of the Irish.
Recipes like these, interviews, photos, news articles, eartheats.org is a one-stop shop for all things foodie. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Carolyn Hemming, Kristen Hess, David Hoppe, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great week. I'm Annie Corrigan.